This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 45 for March 12th, 2006. Via ISDN from his house in somewhere in Northern California. Hello, Doug. From Amsterdam, John C. Dvorak, who is trying to get home. Are you lost, John?
No, I'm leaving tomorrow.
He was at CeBIT in Hanover.
So I guess I had a funny thing happen to me today. It was kind of amusing.
Well, let me introduce the rest and we'll talk about that. So, what time is it, though? Real quickly, what time is it in Amsterdam?
It's a little after 1. A.M.
Sorry, we're keeping you up. All right, we'll move fast here. From via Skype from San Francisco, it's Robert Herron, and good afternoon to you, Robert.
Hello.
And of course, from San Francisco via Skype and DLTV, it is Patrick Norton. Hello, Patrick.
How's it going?
It's going great. Hey, Cranky Geeks, episode 1, did that come out?
Yeah, actually, it's up on, if you go up to www.dl.tv. Scroll about a third of the way down, you will see the links to download the very first show.
So, oh, that's the pilot, but is another show coming out sooner?
Well, it depends on when John ever gets back from Germany.
I guess you can't really do it while you're in Germany. What happened to you that's so funny, John?
So I'm roaming around Amsterdam taking photos in my normal fashion when I hit these little towns. And I got approached by a guy and a girl, a woman with a camera, and there's a guy doing what he calls, ambush journalism for a computer magazine.
Wow. Did he know who you were?
Being followed?
Nah, he didn't know who it was, but he'll find out when he goes to the website, Dvorak.org/blog. Anyway, they asked people on the street about the... About how long they've been using email and what the value of it is, which I thought was amusing.
They've been using it? Wow.
Hmm. Yeah, well, you know, they don't use a lot. Email is pretty new to some people.
Not in Amsterdam, surely.
Well, apparently it is.
You didn't get recognized by any. You didn't get any recognized by any TWiT fans in Amsterdam.
I did in CeBIT a couple, but in Amsterdam, no. I used to have a column. I think that ran in a licensed version of PC Magazine around here, but that they don't have that anymore. So I'm kind of just a normal person here.
It's probably just as well. Nobody was throwing brickbats at you. We missed you at the Apple store, though. They were looking for you with brickbats there.
Well, you know, it's a shame, isn't it?
This is going to be kind of the trade show report because John's got an update on CeBIT. E-Tech just happened to, that's O'Reilly's Emerging Tech Conference, and Doug Kay was down there, and he's going to give us the latest from E-Tech. And joining us a little bit later, Will Harris, who is with a British enthusiast site called bit-tech.net, a great little site, and he was at the Intel Developers Forum, so we'll get the latest on the IDF as well. So a lot of news in the works. I think we could focus on that because there's not a whole lot of news in the rest of the world, except maybe this Google acquisition of Writely, which is the online word processor. Anybody surprised by that?
I was a little surprised because I had visited with the company and they had this roadmap. They were actually going to do a calendaring program or some other things, I guess, which kind of fits in nicely with what Google's up to. I knew that, you know, this is the kind of thing that looks like an M&A company, mergers and acquisitions design, you know, to be bought eventually. But I think this was a little earlier than they were anticipating.
It was quick.
What did they pay for it?
I didn't see a number anywhere. Did anybody see a number?
No.
Writely is, I think, a pretty slick product. Although interestingly, it's not written in PHP or Java or anything you'd expect. It's written in .NET.
I was under the impression it was written in C sharp.
Yeah, exactly. C sharp.
Right.
And .NET.
Okay. .NET. Yes,
yeah. Yeah. So, Scoble.
Well, they were
Microsoft.
When I talked to
him,
I'm sorry. When I talked to him, they were going to recode it in Java.
Oh, interesting. I wonder now because I don't think Google does much .NET stuff. So,
no, nobody does much. Well, I don't know. .NET is a... I don't even want to get started. Sorry.
It's a beastie. It's a little beastie.
Let's just say there's a lot of extremely well-proven and hammered-upon code in everything .NET in my life. So.
Right. No, that's a good point. Was that the talk of eTech, Doug, when you were there?
You know, it was part of, I would say, one of two themes. It's sort of the Web 2.0 theme, if you think about it in those terms. And, of course...
Something you know, get attention, get bought.
Well, eTech was about 50% or maybe even more, you know, new company announcements and particularly companies that were involved in the what Tim O'Reilly refers to as the Web 2.0 stuff. But... you know, it sort of resurfaces that old debate about Google. Is Google going to be a viable alternative to Microsoft? And
well, it sure looks like they're putting an office suite together, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. And, you know, we all thought, I think, that if anything, Google was writing that in-house.
Right.
And now they turn around and buy the core component, which is the word processor.
Michael Arrington, who broke this story, also broke the first pictures I've ever seen of Google Calendar. And I have to say, looking at it, it looks like the typical sparse, ugly Google project. Unimpressive, you know, and nothing compared to, say, something like Yahoo Calendar.
Yeah, but, you know, you might say that about Gmail, but it works.
True.
You know.
True, and if you're already using Gmail, any integration with Gmail would be great.
You know, I had another idea for one of the things that, about Web 2.0. Maybe what it means is Web 2, Microsoft 0.
Well, John, you just wrote a column saying Web 2.0 was just Web 1.0 rewarmed and equally dumb.
It's the same, you know, what you have to do is just, I think there's been some lists put on some websites and some blogs where it shows you, you know, the old name and the new name.
Right.
It's the same thing. They just renamed all these things.
Think free office rightly. Yeah.
Well, there was a discussion about that at eTech, too. I don't know who said it. I wish I could remember. But somebody said that Web 2.0 really is the same thing as Web 1. But what happened in the meantime is that the investment community came in and popped a bubble, or created a bubble and popped it. So this is essentially the geeks taking the web back from the investment community.
I think there was nothing wrong with Web 2.0, except that there wasn't a business model for a lot of these. And now that banner advertising is successful and you can make some money, I mean, yeah, you might see some overheating. I think Google snapping up rightly so quickly is probably some evidence of that, but. Is Web 1.0, was it so very flawed? I mean, who cares that that it was a, you know, investment bust?
Well, except that somebody needed to put a new spin on it so people would pay attention. The techies are doing the same stuff we did all along. We never stopped.
Right.
So it's a continuum. I think John's right in that sense.
Well, you know who else never stopped is Amazon and eBay. And John pointed this out, that the some of those companies just kept on going.
Yeah, so, you know, if you stayed in business, at this point you'd be doing pretty well for yourself.
Right.
Most of the companies that, you know, a lot of these guys, you always have to remember, these investors pulled the plug on some of these guys, and a lot of companies had, you know, a lot of companies did an IPO, and then all that money, the real money that was made on the IPO was made by the middlemen. I mean, the company, if they sold the stock for $10 and it flew to $100. The company didn't get that $90.
Right.
Everybody in the middle did. Now, the thing that's interesting about Google is that they did an auction IPO, which means all the money that was raised by the IPO and where that stock was going to head all went to Google.
Well, nobody said the guys running Google were stupid. You know, and they're also in the rare position of actually having, you know, the entire, you know, Wall Street salivating so desperately they were willing to do anything it would take to get, you know, any kind of money off the
Well, app. The way I looked at it is that if everybody had done back then what Google did today and actually absorbed those profits, and, you know, from the stock going up into the company instead of, you know, getting it, you know, the winners being the middlemen, I think half of these companies that went out of business would probably still be in business.
I don't.
Isn't it a mistake to kind of confuse the investment community and what it's doing with actual technology and innovation? I mean,
well, not when they're the ones paying the bills.
So you're saying that it, by sucking up all the capital, it kept these good companies from surviving.
Well, I'm not saying that. I agree with Patrick that they're not all these companies were good. I mean, some of these ideas were idiotic. But there's a number of the things that could have done at least as well as, you know, some of the MySpace kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think if you look at all the recent acquisitions and compare them to what we saw 5 or 6 years ago, all the acquisitions today are the companies are being led by their founders, and those founders are developers. And if you look back at 2000, 1999, I think at that point, people were acquiring companies that were much more inflated, and the management were the, quote, professional managers. They had already replaced the developers. So these are earlier stage acquisitions, which are essentially almost pure technology. So it's a different world.
And developers are willing to have their companies stay small so that they can reasonably maintain control.
That's right.
They're looking for the
Google acquisition as opposed to a venture round.
Right.
Well, a couple million dollars in pocket is a lot better than a theoretical, $50 million that turns into a $30 million tax debt,
right.
because you can't pay off, your mock earnings off of the sale. I mean, if you look at some of it, it just seems like so much of what a lot of people learned was it's the IPOs just kicked a lot of people's asses. Venture capital kicked a lot of people's asses, When you were watching, it was one thing to have we're the emergent site that's going to be tracking. I mean, how many sites were there that were dedicated to basically to have lawyers and other urban professionals, be able to track their time, in 2-minute chunks for billing, right? Okay, there's room for a couple of those companies, but I remember watching the fifth one open up and receive $11 million in VC funding, and you were just watching, okay ideas to begin with, that there would be four more VCs would be like, oh my God, that's where all the money's going to be, and then they would invest on it, and it was just a mess to watch, and then they'd never ship products or they'd be spending money. I remember watching somebody who had all of this insanely expensive office space downtown, then turn around and buy a retail building to convert it into their main office building in a, in a retail section of San Francisco. And it's just like, what are you, insane? You're peeing away money on.
Well, a lot of these guys were almost encouraged to do that kind of crackpot stuff by the investors. Anyway, I think we're a little off topic here. We should probably get back to was there anything new at the show besides the sudden discovery that Web 2.0 is Web 1.0?
Well, there was a lot of new stuff. What else happened at eTech?
Well, I think one of the themes, sort of continuing from last year, was micro formats. That's one that's sort of been on the back burner. That's, structured content in the form of calendar data or contact data, simple things, but when you put them together, they're fairly powerful. One of the things that was hyped a bit, I didn't fall for it, I don't think, but this was Ray Ozzie showing his basically smart web-based copy-paste thing. Which I think has been shown other places.
Wait a minute. Okay, it's a clipboard that's
web. Clipboard for the web.
For the web.
Right. So the idea is that you, just like you find something on Microsoft's desktop environment, you copy it from one application and paste it to another. Why can't you do that on the web? Why can't you find an address or an RSS feed or some other structured object and paste it from one environment to the other? There was a lot of hype around it. I either missed the point or... or didn't fall for it, but there is the part of it that
you had a blogger.
I guess
that's true. If you were a big blogger, it would be handy. You could cut and paste. But I mean, but it's not text; it's structured
data. Yeah, and when you got listening to the presentations by the calendar guys and the other micro format guys, and there were many presentations about those kinds of tools, it makes some sense.
Are they talking about using kind of an XML? Undercode so that everything can... I mean, that is one of the big issues right now for users is the formats are all over the place.
Yeah, the theory is, Ray is out there saying, well, Microsoft is going to get behind this and it's going to be completely open.
Yeah.
Now, if Ray is saying that, I believe it. If Ray, as part of Microsoft, is saying that, right. I'm not sure I do.
Right. He was using Firefox to demonstrate this, I noticed.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I was in the other room listening.
I think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't work in Internet Explorer.
Yeah, so that was one of the big things. And I guess the only other big topic, which again is a something we've seen before at meetings like eTech, is the whole Ajax thing. Which comes back to the word processing and so forth. So there are a lot of people developing Ajax-based applications, and now people are also sort of going to Ajax 2.0, which I just made up, but it's recognizing that the performance of Ajax can be problematic. So a couple of proposals, one called Comet, for example, as a way to mitigate some of the performance problems of an Ajax architecture.
It's a faster Ajax, or...?
Yeah, it's just smarter. It just recognizes that, you can't, send, half a dozen XML packets for every keystroke.
Right. Getting back to what Ray Ozzie was doing, I mean, I like the idea if you could get people to agree. He demonstrated, apparently, copying a an event from Eventful and pasting it into Microsoft's Live calendar. But you've got to get Eventful to agree and Microsoft to agree and everybody else to agree. How realistic is that?
I think it is, because the microformat guys seem to be looking for anybody who will adopt their standards. They've created these standards and no one's showing up to the party. And so if Microsoft turns around and says, we'll endorse them and we'll put them into our products, there's plenty of motivation then for everybody else
to
adopt.
We're not talking vCal or vCards. Is it something new and different
from
that?
No, it includes vCal and vCards. It includes all that stuff, but it's more.
Right.
You know, and then there are people looking at what is the question is, what is the semantic component? If you paste an RSS feed into a web page, what does that mean? Does that mean you just get a little orange button?
Right.
Or do you get the content of the feed, or, you know, what does it mean? So there's more work to do. That's
I think
for
we should
sure.
get Dave Weiner to work on this. That'd really help.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
It solved the whole problem. Anything exciting at CeBIT? Well, I can tell you one thing that CeBIT revealed, which was Microsoft's Origami. Did you go see that, John?
Oh yeah, I got the demo and I played with it, and I got the lecture from Bill Mitchell, the head guy who did the thing. Right. He was in Hanover to promote it. There's a bunch of TV reports that were done on it. Let me summarize. It's a small notepad,
but no keyboard.
No, actually, there's no keyboard, but I've got some stuff. I've got I think tomorrow or Tuesday for sure, PCMag.com will have a slideshow that I'll be putting up tomorrow of some of the pictures I took at the show, and I'll have a lot of at least two or three pictures of the couple of the Origami device and some of these ideas that they've got. It's a nice little thing. It's no big deal.
It could have
expensive.
It could have a keyboard, I guess. There's nothing.
Yeah, no, you can hook a keyboard too. In fact, they have a little pack you can buy that you hook it into. It's like a big kind of a wallet, you know, and you stick the thing on one side.
What's the market? Is it for somebody who wants to sit in their living room and access? I notice it's kind of a.
There's a market?
No, it doesn't need to be a market. I noticed resolution is kind of DVD resolution, so it would, I guess, be appropriate for playing back DVDs remotely.
It only has 2.5 hour battery life.
Oh. Yeah,
I asked him.
A Game Boy for adults.
There was somebody on television from Microsoft. Maybe it's the same guy who said the target market was soccer moms who have, you know, five or 10 minutes while they're waiting for their kids. I'm thinking that's not much of a market.
I don't think so. I asked them specifically about this and they wouldn't tell me.
They didn't know.
I mean, I asked them specifically about their market research and what they said we can't say.
Bill Gates wanted it.
That could be it.
Bill Gates would actually do the market research and make sure there was actually a market for it. I mean, the other thing is no U.S. like portable vendor is touching this.
I know it's all
Samsung's
Korean. Yeah.
It's a couple other vendors you've never even heard of. You know, Samsung's the main one. The first one comes out with 3 hours of battery life. The physical specs are, you know, the thumb keyboard is definitely going to be in there for most people. Keyboards are optional. You know, it's basically a modified version of the tablet OS from Microsoft. You know, it's like Media Center meets tablet PC with even less battery life than a PDA and a larger form factor. You know, so are the verticals going to want it? Maybe, but hospitals and, you know, insurance adjusters seem happy with full-size tablet PCs. Are people going to want it at home? Well, do you want to spend $600 or $800 for one of these things for a 7-inch or smaller screen?
Is this bigger than the Nokia 7770? It's a little bit bigger, isn't it?
No, it's a lot bigger.
A lot bigger. Yeah. All right. It's like half a screen.
Yeah, it's a good size paperback.
No, it's bigger than that. It's about two-thirds the size of a regular notebook.
But, Patrick, you were all excited about the Sony e-book. I mean, couldn't this be just... You know, it's kind of like an ebook.
Yeah,
no,
Patrick.
It's not like an ebook at all. Because what's
Come on, Patrick. Admit it.
Hold on. Stop. Pause. Both of you. Right? There's three things about the ebook. A whole bunch of storage, which is easy, right? The screen, which doesn't refresh, so it doesn't suck up battery
That's
life.
A good point,
and it doesn't
right?
kill your eyes, right? Right? And three, you know, some way of getting content onto it. Now we'll find out whether or not Sony's screwed that up or not in a few weeks when the Sony Reader shows up. We're going to get one in for testing. But what it has is thousands of pages of battery life. You know what I mean? There's a lot of storage on there, and the battery life is going to be phenomenal. You know what I mean?
But now, you can't watch movies on it or listen to music.
Well, you know, I mean, here's, you know, this is something that, you know, the entire industry has been going around in circles on since, you know, before I was writing about this stuff, is do we need single devices that are designed to do one thing really, really well, or do we do another device that mostly does one thing and then half-asses four other things? You know what I mean? Does your GPS, you know, does your automotive, you know, navigational system also need to be an MP3 player? You know what I mean? Does your MP3 player also need to display movies? Does your, you know what I mean? It's like, you know,
I'll tell you something. I think that this small tablet from Microsoft would make a, if they had a cradle for it, make a great, great GPS device for the car if it was powered. Seriously,
it's the right size and a good looking screen, and yeah,
it's a little big. And it's,
but that's anyway, arguably the biggest problem with it is that it doesn't do any one thing particularly well. It doesn't have.
Well, that's why, by the way, that's why it's called Origami. Nobody mentioned this. In fact, I didn't write it in the column. I just did one for MarketWatch about it. But I asked him specifically, why was it called Origami? He says, well, it's like, because I thought it was going to be something that folded up, right? And so he says, well, it's like a piece of paper, you know, that you can fold it up different ways and it does different things. So our device does all these different things. So exactly what you described is why it was named Origami in the first place.
Terrific.
Anyway, let me change the topic real quick and just say the real news of this show seemed to me to be, besides RFID, which was all over the place, I mean, it's like everybody's building this RFID gear. It's kind of frightening, actually. Are these new phones that you're going to be seeing? And I think this is going to be your phone du jour, which is looks like a regular phone but the screen kind of gimbals and goes sideways, so it looks kind of like a T.
Yeah, Nokia is doing. Isn't that the 90? The Nokia 90 was.
Everybody had one of them, and they're all like, you know, this big screen, so you can watch movies, I guess, sideways, or you can play games and have the, I don't know. I thought it was kind
of. That's Origami. Now that's an Origami device. It folds up in different ways.
Yeah, that actually probably is more Origami than the Microsoft product.
Samsung showed a 10 megapixel phone at CeBIT. I don't know what you would do with a 10 megapixel phone.
Very detailed images.
I wonder if that's using the Foveon sensor, because I didn't see that phone.
That's pretty, and it is, by the way, just like it's another one of those folding. Oh no, actually, this one's not. The Grundig was the one that's kind of folding. That was a 6 megapixel.
The question is whether that's going to have, you know, decent optics. You know what I mean, 10 megapixels of bad light is, you know, very detailed bad light.
yeah, exactly. That's just kind of kooky. I think that's a number so that they can. For bragging rights more than anything else, right?
Well, retail salespeople love stuff like that.
Sure.
You know, the new Samsung phone's got 10 megapixels, and that's really the thing if you want the good photos of the kids. You do want the good photos of the kids, don't you, Leo?
Yeah. John, did you see any SED TVs there? Because I'm seeing now that they're saying SEDs will be coming in about a year.
Yeah, there were these little bitty TVs that run on, you know, handheld PCs and whatever all over the place.
Yeah.
Like lots of them.
Did you see that, Robert? That here's the announcement from Toshiba and Canon. They call this a major industry milestone, a once in 50 years historical turning point for the TV industry, comparable to the initial introduction of CRT. This is that new SED. Have you seen
it? Has the potential.
It's a surface conduction electron emitter display. Last time we talked about this, you said it was more like a CRT than an LCD.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something about that technology. That used to be called, if you ask anybody about that, used to be called an FED, a field effect display or whatever, or field emitter.
Right.
And these are what we call FEDs. Two companies, probably the biggest bust in the history of Silicon Valley was a company called Candlescent, I believe. And they billions of dollars essentially squandered, not that much, but close to it maybe. But whatever the case is, this technology has never cut the mustard. It's not going to happen now. It's over.
I think you're mixing up technologies. I'm pretty sure.
No, it's the same technology. It's exactly the same technology. It's just another like Web 2.0. It's just renamed and kind of tweaked a little bit.
Well, it's really Canon and Toshiba, two people you normally don't associate with display technologies per se. I mean, the cameras and broadcast equipment, sure, but this is their baby as far as introducing not only a flat display technology, which initially they'll be 55 inches, at least that's what they reported back at CES, but it also offers performance on a level above and beyond any other flat panel you can buy today, which, you know, yes, when they first release, they will be expensive. And
I'll tell you something else. It won't work.
What do you mean it won't work?
We've seen them, haven't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys saw a lab version.
Well, they had a dozen of them at least. They had a dozen, what were they, 36-inch 720p displays for demonstration purposes, showing everything from full motion video to rather challenging scenes. Yes, it's all set up on their back end and hand massaged and whatnot, but as a demonstration product, and after looking at enough bad TVs this past year in the consumer side of things, yeah, they have a potential technology that could easily end up wiping the floor with plasmas and the LCD market as well.
So just, would you delay? I mean, they say they won't start manufacturing.
Can we put some money on this dead end?
It's they're not going to start manufacturing for another year. They won't start shipping for another year and a half. So this could be
really. Is that the latest projected number?
That's what Toshiba and Canon are saying now, right? that they're starting production in July 2007, and they want to get out by Q4. Just in time for the 2008 Olympics, I think is what they're shooting for.
Perfect timing.
Which does maybe give some credence to what John's saying. I mean, if they had production models in January, but they're still not going to start making them till July 2007, there may be some issues they still have to resolve.
Yeah, but then the guy in the New York Times today said that broadcast television is dead anyway.
Good point.
So,
but we still will watch TVs, won't we? Or maybe.
But anyway, there was a lot of little TVs at the thing, but they didn't have any of those sets that I saw.
All right.
I mean, there could have been. I mean, that show. You have to remember that CBIT is a the number of the they actually calculate the number of miles of aisles there are. 30.
Wow.
So how is it that you refuse to go to CES, which is a show arguably, say, 10 times smaller, yet you end up at CBIT, which is, the granddaddy of all consumer electronic shows.
Well, I'll tell you why, and it's a pretty simple reason, is that the CES is overcovered by American journalists, and CBIT's not. I mean, whatever I cover there, it's pretty much nobody else is covering it. I mean, there's nobody. They have very few writers there from the USA, so nobody gets any information. And basically, I'm just reinventing the wheel down at CES. So what's the point?
I don't know. It's been interesting to watch, like Engadget and a couple other places have been doing some pretty good.
Did they send some people?
Engadget's doing. They're doing the best job of covering these things.
They're coming on strong. That's an interesting choice for them. Maybe to become the trade show journal.
But, you know, as far as SEDS go, one last comment was that it is a new technology, and you could have said something very similar about the whole LCOS, the liquid crystal.
We did. I think we did.
Rear projection technology. You could say that, you know, why bring in another technology that has, you know, it's going to have to compete against the LCD rear projection and the DLP rear projection that are so firmly entrenched right now, yet now anybody who's in a market seriously for a new TV using rear projection is... LCOS offers the best of all worlds at this point.
I think a year ago we were saying LCOS was dead, that they couldn't get the chips out, the companies had given up.
I'm going back to that point of view, by the way.
Well, Sony seems to be doing pretty well with its LCOS displays.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that they can't. I'm not saying it's impossible to make these things, but I was hanging out with one of the guys from one of the Electronic Buyer's Guide or Electronic Products, Hearst Publication, and he's like kind of setting me straight on some of these things, and LCOS is still a little bit on the cusp.
Huh. Interesting.
Well, for projectors or for full-size screens?
Everything. Just on the cusp, period. There's some issues.
Well, it's only a projection technology. That's all it's used
for. Well, and that's why SET is exciting.
Yeah,
it's
basically a projection. See, the problem with the projection technology is essentially the Samsung, you know, invention. I guess everybody's going to start doing this. The elimination of the color wheel with LEDs.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're going to use... And once you eliminate the color wheel, I mean, now there's no moving parts and things change. The cost structure changes dramatically. Hmm. And also you've gotten rid of the replaceable bulb and you replace it with LEDs.
Best thing.
I mean, it's going to be hard to compete with that kind of thing for projectors.
What was going on with RFID? Is that there was a lot of RFID there?
It just seems to me that they're going to just RFID everything. All of Europe wants to put RFIDs on everything so they can track shipments of, you know, trucks and everything else. I mean, it's mostly for tracking, but you can just see it just headed to, you know, having people track too.
Do you get the sense that they're less concerned in Europe about privacy than we are here in the States?
Well, they didn't seem to be coming up in the conversation with RFIDs. I can tell you that.
That's the first thing that comes up here. You talk about RFID.
I mean, what item that you buy in any major retailer doesn't have an RFID tag on it in this country? You walk into anything that has that protection system as you walk out of a store.
But they take it off, right?
No. Oh, they did, or they fry the chip internally before they hand it to you. I mean, because you look at like a DVD packaging, the chip itself is built into the packaging, and then they just
is that what that white strip is? That little white strip that's in there?
Yeah, yeah, a little gobble, like, yeah. It's an RFID
puffy
tag.
But plastic
that's
thing.
That's not an actual RFID tag.
Sure, it is.
Are you sure?
Yeah, that's
it
how
contains
it works,
I mean, all anything you can put a serial number to and scan it, or okay, say so yes, I belong here or not here.
It's a crude version.
Same thing as what you put in your AML or...
Oh, I think it's inevitable. I think GPS everywhere, RFID everywhere, and then nobody will ever get lost again. No body, no thing will ever get lost again.
No, that's a wishful thing.
And then, no, I'm not even wishing for it. I'm dreading it. Are you kidding?
Well, yeah, no, but I mean, you're still going to be able to get lost. There's going to be coverage problems, you know. There's going to be this half... You know, there'll still be huge swaths of the American West that doesn't have cell phone coverage. I mean, Procter & Gamble, it's like nuts. They're claiming, you know, if they RFID tag everything, they're claiming that they can get some insane, like, save like $1 billion a year by reducing, you know, lost product lost in shipping and shrinkage. Right. But then, then you turn around and you look and you start to realize that, you know, RFID tags don't work really well if you, let's say, have, you know, 6 containers full of dishwashing soap because the RF gets absorbed by the liquid inside the containers. You know, there's still a lot of stuff to be worked out to make this work.
I have faith.
I think there are more of them out there than we think. I bought a shirt a couple of weeks ago, you know, and they took off the big white plastic tag, and I got it home, and a little tiny tag was inside the shirt. So I'm not sure that we're not all carrying around more tags than we think.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying here.
Yeah.
Where there's no privacy.
So what do you have to do? Just microwave everything you buy, I guess.
Well, I've been looking. I mean, you now, more and more phones, you know, phones have had GPS capability or location capability for a long time, but more and more phones are supporting things like Telenav, where you basically, your phone is a GPS device, and you just dial it in, and it's pretty cool.
Hey, when it works, it's great.
Yeah, it's a great idea. So of course, the Intel Developers Forum was going on in Silicon Valley this week. And Intel actually scooped Microsoft by showing the origami a little bit early, but they also showed some new chips and, of all things, a water cooling system for overclockers. We sent we didn't send him, he was there, but we talked to Will Harris from BitTech, which is a great UK enthusiast site, and he gave us his lowdown on the Intel Developers Forum.
There's a lot of cool stuff there this time. The big news was... Intel released what it calls its new Core microarchitecture, which is going to debut in its new processors, which are called Conroe. And Conroe is going to be the chip, basically, that ends up in the new Apple Macs.
Oh, interesting. So Conroe is the successor to Core Duo?
Well, it's sort of. Yeah, it's kind of the successor to the old Pentium 4.
And
so when Apple, you know, says, well, we're going to hold off on replacing the Power Macs until the end of the year, they're waiting for this chip, basically. Conroe to be finished up.
Is it Yona Part 2, or where does it fit in the roadmap?
It's an evolution. So if you take the original Pentium M, which was such a massive success for Intel
Israeli designers who are just
It turns out, you know, we can make a really high-powered processor that really doesn't consume any heat. And they said, well, let's move that onto the desktop. And so this is what you've seen now with Core Duo and Core Solo, which is in all the new Mac stuff.
Codenamed Yona, right?
And those were, Yona and I think Banias.
Banias was Pentium M, yeah, and then the Yona was a successor to that. Yeah.
They have too many code names.
I know, and now Conroe is the successor.
And so
Yona.
Conroe is the successor to that, and there's 3 products. There is a Conroe, which is desktop, Merom, which is laptop, and Woodcrest, which is server, which you don't really care about, but they're all based on this new Core microarchitecture, which is instead of doing. Instead of having everything go faster and scaling clock speeds all the time, we'll make it more efficient and we'll make it wider. So the Core microarchitecture has like 4 execution engines in each core instead of 3 compared to the last generation. So immediately you just add on a bunch of capacity there. It's got all kinds of new logic engines for rearranging and combining processor instructions. And better ways of accessing memory, and it's got a more intelligent way of sharing cache between the dual cores. And basically, it's just designed to be really efficient, really fast, really sleek, It's going to deliver a hell of a lot more performance for a hell of a lot less power.
Is it all dual core? Will they have a solo?
It's all dual core from now on, I think. They don't care about solo.
Not at all. How about quad core? Is that silly to even talk about?
Absolutely not. So they actually demoed for the first time quad core in a gaming chip.
Oh, my God.
There's a gaming chip called, I think it's called Kentsfield, which is due to arrive in January 2007. And that is four physical cores. It's going to be fast as heck. They showed it playing. Do you know the Guild Wars MMO?
Yeah.
So they showed it running Guild Wars, and it looked pretty good.
I bet it looked pretty good. Now, are they hyper-threading these at all, or is that
no,
gone?
I think they're dropping hyper-threading. Okay. Hyper-threading was a great way to get people introduced to the idea of parallelism. But it's really not that efficient now when you've got so much actual hardware to do that instead.
Now on bittech.net, I know you've benchmarked Conroe already. I don't know how you did it so fast, but
we were kind of lucky. We had Intel decided, you know, hey, we actually quite like you guys. We'll let you come and have a go on this system.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And so the guys at Anantech actually got to spend a fair amount of time, just benchmarking it. Intel had a Conroe system and an AMD FX60 system. And if you know the AMD product line, the FX60 is like the hardcore gamer product.
Right.
And they were showing, hey, this is a lot faster than the AMD system, and Anantech published that. But then there was lots of controversy about, like, well, hey, you're publishing results for an AMD system that's being configured by Intel.
Right.
So who knows what they've done to that?
No, I agree. So, that's a little suspicious. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So when we went in, we had the chance and we said, hey, actually, forget about the AMD system in the corner. We just want you to run one of our benchmarks on the Conroe system so we can compare it to all the systems that we've done in the labs back home.
You use FEAR for your demo.
Yeah, so FEAR was something they had installed. It was fairly easy to run. And it's something that we've seen in our labs gives a really good indication of CPU scaling. If you crank back the resolution and you crank back all the details, basically you become you take the graphics out of the equation, you become really CPU limited as to how fast can the CPU just keep churning this stuff out.
Perfect, that makes sense.
Absolutely. So we ran that on there and we compared it to our results from the labs back home and it was just stonking.
Oh, it's amazing.
It was really, really like an order of magnitude faster even than our really well-configured AMD system at home.
Your Pentium XE955, which is your reference, was 213 frames per second, which, by the way, is pretty fast.
Absolutely.
346 for Conroe.
Yeah, and even better, you know, you take the top-end system you can buy, an FX60 machine, that was 253. You're adding on like a whole another 100 frames a second to that.
It's more than 30% faster.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
So it looks really, really, really good.
That's truly amazing. Well, so Conroe is the thing to look at. I know they also showed though prototypes of Origami, so they have another product.
Yeah,
there as well.
so they kind of pre-announced that for Microsoft.
Yeah, Microsoft must be a little annoyed.
Well, they made a big thing about, you know, we're going to announce it on Thursday at CeBIT in Germany.
Right.
But of course, you know, we were all standing around on Monday going, hey, we're looking at this right now.
This is it.
Here it is.
Yeah.
And so they had a bunch of different concept machines. They had a couple of actual retail machines and that they were showing. And it was... I don't know. I'm not sure I can get very excited about it. It's kind of like just a tablet PC, but a bit smaller, but not really small enough.
Right.
It's not like you can put it in your pocket.
No, I agree.
Maybe you can put it in a handbag.
since I don't carry one, I don't know about you guys. Yeah.
It's not got a cell phone in it.
Right.
And so it's not like you can replace your cell phone. It's kind of just like, well, I'll take it on the plane and watch some movies, but what else am I actually going to do with it?
Microsoft just won't let go of this tablet PC idea. And in fact, this is not much different than their tablet that they announced. I can't remember, was it called the HPC? The idea was you'd kind of be sitting in your living room controlling your TV with it, which it's just never caught on.
No, it doesn't really work. And it's certainly not, you know, when the Origami speculation came out, it was, you know, Microsoft is readying an iPod killer. And this is certainly not by any stretch of the imagination an iPod killer.
No.
It's an entirely different usage model, and I don't think it's a usage model that's as popular. I mean, you've got to spend, like $1,000 on one of these things.
Right. We're talking to Will Harris. He's the editor at bit-tech.net, a British tech enthusiast website, a great website. He's been at the Intel Developers Forum for the last few days. I noted that Don McDonald took a little swipe at Apple at his keynote. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Don is a fellow Brit, and he's got a kind of wry sense of humor, and he doesn't like to be outdone on anything, I don't think. I mean, he invented the marketing concept for Centrino, so he's a pretty clever guy.
No kidding. We got a big raise for that one.
But he was saying, you know, he alluded to the fact, you know, Jobs in his keynote a while back when he announced Front Row was saying, hey, we've got this new Apple remote, and it's only got 6 buttons. It's just got, you know, it's just got the little circle. It kind of looks like an iPod Shuffle. Look at how stupidly complicated our competitors' remote controls are. Right. And they showed the Windows Media Remote, right, which has like 50 buttons on
crazy.
It or something.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of skipping over the fact that Windows Media Center does about, you know, 5 times the thing that Front Row does.
You only need 6 buttons on Front Row.
Absolutely. Right. We'll gloss over that. But Don said, you know, hey, we thought of the challenge was a can we make a remote control with no buttons? Can we best Steve Jobs? And so he showed some basically voice control of Windows Media Center. So basically the premise was you say, hey, computer, what time is Family Guy on TV? And the computer goes, let me think about that. And it searches the guide for Family Guy and brings you up. And then you can say, hey, record this episode of Family Guy, and it automatically records it for you.
So does it work?
Well, the problem was it took him about 5 goes to actually get it to work.
Yeah.
Standing on the stage going, computer, what time is Family Guy on? And the computer's going, I don't really know what you're talking about.
Yeah. That's my problem with all of these. It's exactly what always happens. Yeah. If computer, light on, and you end up shouting.
Absolutely. And the trouble is, you know, you've got multiple systems in your house and you say, computer, record Family Guy, and you've got 5 systems in the same room all start recording Family Guy, you know? No. So that wasn't particularly a compelling demonstration.
Anything else you saw there that you found of interest, the idea?
Yeah, I mean, they had you're aware of the sort of the kind of liquid cooling enthusiast hobby of
I saw this on your site. They got an extreme edition of 5 gigahertz.
Yeah, so the idea is that,
man,
you know, you see for years we've had water cooling systems in PCs. Where you have a reservoir and a pump and you throw that around with some tubing. That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, and they're quieter, they're cooler, you can overclock well. Yeah.
But Intel has decided, well, hey, we're gonna try and take this to the next level. We wanna make something that does the same thing, but which we can ship in a whole bunch of systems. You can't really ship a water cooling system because, you know, a tube bursts, you've got water going everywhere. Right. It's a real pain. So they said, well, we're gonna make a water block that sits on the CPU. We're going to integrate a centrifugal pump into the water block.
Wow.
So that all is like one solid unit. And then we're just going to have that go through some metal pipes to a heat exchanger, like a traditional radiator. Mm-hmm. And what they did was, you know, Intel's R&D is pretty has a pretty nice budget, has a lot of expertise. And they were just able to take this concept of water cooling far beyond what the kind of niche industry that it always has been able to do. And so they had, a Pentium Extreme Edition, which ships at 3.8 gigahertz, and they had that up over 5 gigahertz.
Wow.
Still operating well within temperature ranges that are acceptable.
Wow.
And it was just sort of like, wow, you can suddenly, it's going to be $50 because they made sure that when they created it, they used easily available components, you know, stuff that if you're a CPU maker, you can just go and get out of China.
It works on an ATX motherboard or a BTX motherboard.
Yeah. And it works on either of them. You just, you know, you plonk it on, you set up your heat exchanger, make sure the pipes are okay, and it looks like a really elegant solution.
Isn't it a little strange to see Intel promoting overclocking? I mean, it seems like that's the last thing they'd want to do.
Well, that is exactly what I said to the guys. And actually, you know, it's quite a good story. There is inside Intel, you know, Intel, as you say, is a very kind of anti-overclocking, very by the book. There is a little team of enthusiasts that works in the Intel R&D department, and they're sort of like a secret society, and they have a meeting every week. You know, on a Friday, they go and find like a spare room somewhere in Intel. And it's like invitation only. You can't turn up unless you've been like verified as one of these enthusiastic kind of people, and they just sit there and brainstorm ways to make Intel products more friendly to enthusiasts.
I love these
guys are enthusiasts themselves.
What a great job.
So they set up these secret clubs and and now they've done stuff like so they got this product green lighted, and they got it, you know, you're going to see this being rolled out for the rest of the year as a really good and out-of-the-box performance cooling system.
I would buy it in a minute, especially coming from Intel. You know it's going to work, you know?
Yeah, and it's been, you know, verified. It's going to work for at least 3 years.
And are they saying are they saying to overclock with it, or are they just saying use
Absolutely.
This?
Absolutely.
They are.
Well, I mean, they're putting more overclocking features onto their main boards. One of the things they also showed was that they've started putting heat sinks on the voltage regulators on the motherboard. And, of course, the only reason you'd ever put heat sinks on a voltage regulator on a motherboard is to crank up the voltage regulators a lot. And so they're really getting Intel to move away from this, hey, we're not gonna do anything in this area, to, hey, actually, maybe we could make some money in this. You know,
This works so well. I think hell is actually freezing over right now.
Well,
unbelievable.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, they really are starting to get it a little bit.
Will, I want to thank you so much. This has been great to get your perspective on the Intel Developer Forum, which is wrapping up. We're just wrapped up. We're recording this on Thursday the 9th. For more information, bit.tech.net. You're going to put more articles up. There's some great stuff on there. And I have to say, this is going to be I'm bookmarking it. It's going to be a regular visit.
Well, thank you very much, Leo. And thanks very much for having me on.
Really appreciate it. Will Harris, editor of bit.tech.net. .net with the IDF update.
And Leo, before you go to that, I'm going to take off.
Okay.
So I'll see you guys next week.
We're back already.
Oh. Well, never mind.
But I will let you go because it is like it's almost 2 o'clock in the morning. So
yeah, I got to get to bed. I got an early plane tomorrow. I'm only staying up because of our fantastic fans who listen to the show.
Thank you, John. It's wonderful.
Are you going to suck up, John?
You're going to be back next week.
I'll be back. I'm be back tomorrow. I mean, essentially. So
okay. Well,
I'll see you guys.
Safe trip home. Thank you, John.
Thanks.
All right, guys. That's great. Good night. Good night.
Leo, speaking of Intel and Microsoft, what's this story about EFI? I wasn't familiar with EFI until you pointed it out to me.
Let me bring that up, and then I would like to get kind of, especially Robert and Patrick, your take on Intel's announcements at IDF, because there's some interesting stuff coming out of there. One of the kind of surprising announcements from Microsoft this week was that they are not going to support the new EFI BIOS, something they co-jointly developed with Intel, in Vista. They're going to stick with the 20-year-old BIOS, which is kind of a surprise. It's just one more thing that's being pulled out of Vista, if you ask me. EFI stands for the Extensible Firmware Interface. And irony of ironies, Apple's already using it in their Intel Macs. And I think one of the reasons people paid attention to this, although I don't think it's the most important part of the story, is that it means that Vista won't boot on any of these Macintels because they need EFI support. But more than that, I mean, I think it's Microsoft saying, God, we can't even support our own technology, EFI, in our brand new operating system. What's going on with Vista?
Well, I think they're doing it for 64-bit PCs, not 32-bit.
They say they're going to. It won't appear until Vista Server Edition, and it requires 64-bit. But Mac's doing it with 32-bit.
Could that be the reason or the means that they will keep the OS from migrating so easily then to the Apple platform?
Why would they want to, though? I don't understand why they'd want to prevent that.
It's
more money for them if they sell more, if it runs on more hardware. Why would it be?
Or will this also give the Windows side, with all of its user base as big as it is, will that just give more people the option then to try out the OS on their existing hardware?
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's an upgrade issue.
I mean, some of the reports I'm reading on this says Vista will support EFI on 64-bit processors. Windows XP will support it through what basically amounts to, you know, a compatibility module.
This is Andrew Ritz, who's the Microsoft Development Manager. He was talking to IDF. He said there will never be any support for booting Windows via EFI on systems with 32-bit processors. It will only be on 64-bit. And EFI will not be seen in any version of Windows until the release of Longhorn Server.
Yeah, but aren't they supposed to deliver Server at the same time?
But are you buying Server? Or are you going to buy? You're just going to buy Vista, right?
No, he just said it's not going to appear anywhere until that. Maybe that means they just need to finish the code, and then they can.
Maybe they'll put in everything then.
Because they've also said, and you know, they've also said that Yeah, I mean, 64-bit processors, and they've also said in other places that there will fundamentally be a bootstrapping device to get EFI, to get older operating systems work with EFI. It'll be interesting if they draw the line on that, because, you know, they've been doing some funny things that's, you know, reek of forced operating system upgrades lately.
Windows
XP, they said Friday, Windows XP will boot under EFI when a compatibility support module is present.
When it is.
Write that, I don't know.
When they ship that. It said the decision to, quote, reprioritize EFI development to the server version of Windows was based on a lack of available desktop PCs with EFI. So it's a chicken and egg thing where nobody supports it, so they don't have to support it in the software. And then, again, quoting Ritz, no, combination of factors changed our plans. The big one, in my opinion, was platform availability. With this huge move to 64-bit-based platforms, and for us to support it, we needed to see a large heterogeneous sample of 64-bit implementations. So basically they're saying there's not enough 32-bit hardware out there.
So yeah. Does it mean that for us Mac hardware fans that the Windows issue is completely dead, or is this something that's hackable?
Well, it's dead for now.
It's hackable.
Yeah, I mean, once they release the module, I suppose you could do it.
Okay.
Or, you know, I'm always pleasantly surprised, shocked, and amazed by what hackers come up with.
I mean, you saw the Linux running on a Nano, and they've got MAME running on Linux running Pac-Man on a Nano. So, in fact, somebody built a little arcade case that was Nano size. You insert the Nano into the arcade case.
That's cool.
I didn't see if it had a little tiny little trackball, but obviously, you're right. There are people with a lot more time on their hands than common sense. So what about this? The first thing that shocked me was there was some very interesting stuff out of IDF. But I think when Will said that Intel was showing a water-cooled system and encouraging overclocking, I mean, that's a shocker.
Very cool. Well,
Intel's also admitted that AMDs are running faster. And Intel's, yeah, they've gone from, you know, clock speed on processor is the most important marketing tool we have in the retail market space to doing like the BMW style numbering system. They've gone, you know, and now they're saying it's all about reducing power consumption.
Right.
It's all about making corporate buyers happy and also, hey, reducing your home electricity bill. So they're, you know, they're fine. I think they're finally reacting to AMD's success.
And saying, what the heck? I mean, how many people, is it going to cost them anything that people are overclocking Intel processors? I don't think.
You know, I don't know how much they were excited about overclocking so much as they were, you know, the Intel advanced liquid cooling technology.
Yeah, they were. They certainly were.
I remember for the Pentium 4 launch, though, they did a similar thing where they showed what cooler they were using, but I believe they had a completely sealed box and they just sat there and ramped up the front side bus speed until the thing finally froze. But I mean, it hit like 4.5 gigahertz back in the day when that actually meant something.
True.
But it's nice to actually see them come up with a decent cooler that can actually support, hey, maybe their previous Prescott parts as well, which were incredibly notorious for being arguably the hottest CPUs you could put into a computer. And their own, Intel's own coolers sometimes weren't enough under certain case designs and certain airflow designs to keep up with the heat that thing was capable of putting off. So it's nice to see them focusing on as much as the low power per computing part, you know, the fact that they can, you know, make them more efficient and change the architecture to, you know, do more with fewer pipelines and also the smaller build processes. But just on top of that, put a good cooler on top that you can say, you know what, here, even if you want to overclock down the road, you'll have the headroom and the coolers available for you to do that as well.
And as Will said, new chip architecture, Conroe, Merom, and Woodcrest respectively, desktop, laptop, and server. What do you think of these Conroe chips?
I mean, I'm watching people who cover chips for a living that are literally like, I mean, we had, Lloyd Case was on talking about Conroe on Thursday's episode of DLTV, and he's just stoked because they're looking at phenomenal performance improvements and phenomenal reductions in power consumptions and a pretty heavy re-architecture that, you know, if we'll wait until we actually have the chips in our hands to test them, but it looks like they're going to be unbelievably fast.
Will's site had a did have some bench. They were able to do some benchmarking at IDF, and yes, absolutely stunning.
I want to see shipping parts.
Well, benchmarked. I agree. It always looks good when they're doing the demo, but still. Pretty impressive, and as Wiz Will said, this is clearly the chip that Apple was waiting for right. its high end machines,
for the desktop.
Yeah,
and it's amazing. I mean, they've dropped it's a 14 stage pipeline instead of a 30 stage pipeline, you know, which slows down the clock frequency but makes it a lot more efficient.
Isn't it funny? Because for a long time the push was how big can we make this pipeline, and then they hit Prescott, and it was, oh my God, it's not working anymore. We've gone too far. So they're pulling way back on that.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I mean, you know, each side of the core has 64 KB L1 cache.
Wow.
And there's like 4 megabytes of shared L2 cache. And the sharing on the 4 megabytes of L2 cache is dynamic. It's going to be really interesting. It's going to be interesting to watch what this does to Chondro does for desktop performance and Merom does for mobile performance. You know, and they're saying like a lot of this doesn't actually require. One of the things they've done is they've set it up so the SSE instructions will take the entire, like, the SSE engine is 128 bits, so they can now, a single clock cycle, execute all the SSE instructions.
Wow.
Awesome.
Yeah. And you, that you really see benefit there in transcoding, encoding. In 3D gaming, you really see a big, big improvement. Anytime you're working with a mass of data, that's where you're really going to get some benefit out of that.
So that's going to be, it's going to be interesting to see. And it's supposed to ship by, you know, the end of this spring. So if you're thinking about buying a notebook, man, or a desktop, it might be worth waiting. You know,
a Merom notebook would be pretty awesome. I mean, I think that might be the notebook I'm waiting for.
Yeah. So, and it's Q2, Q3 of 2006. So.
That's when it's coming out. Okay.
Yeah.
Any other stories, cool. You guys? We pretty much have used up our allotted time. Is there anything else you guys?
There's one thing I liked that I saw at eTech was a company, EVDB, the Events and Venues Database.
Yeah, I like them.
Yeah, they've got some great stuff. Brian Deere, who was formerly with MP3.com, is heading that up.
They want to be the IMDB of concerts and shows and events.
They already are, actually. They're doing a great job. I mean, they don't have the scale, perhaps, yet. But they came out with a really interesting concept there, which they call eventful demand. And it's just interesting because you go to the site and you decide what event you'd like to see.
Oh.
And you create that event, and people participate and vote or whatever, and... I think you're going to see that as an interesting sort of a
way for fans to kind of get back to the promoters and say, hey, we need a Beatles reunion.
Yeah, it's an interesting twist on one of the theme of the show this year was the attention economy. And as Doc Searles has said, maybe what it ought to be is the intention economy. And so this is turning around and putting it in the hands more of the community.
Now, I have to say, some of the demands are kind of interesting. I'm looking right now, and this is brand new. They've just launched it. But demand number one, they want to see the impeachment of George W. Bush at the Washington Metro Arena. So obviously, some people are being a little silly.
Well, I thought this was kind of like Polestar, only with interaction.
What's Polestar?
For fans and stuff. Well, Polestar is basically tracks pretty much... if not, pretty much all the major acts that tour in North America list their tours on here.
Oh, that's neat. Well, you know, one of the top vote getters right now is our buddy Will Wheaton. They want him to do an event at the San Diego Metro in the San Diego Metro area.
I think it's meetup, it's flash mobs, it's all this sort of coming together in another form.
Well,
flash mobs scare me.
You know, it's only a matter of time before people start putting twit on the road. And I just want to stop you right there, because unless you're going to pay for it, we ain't going anywhere. It's tough enough to get everybody together by Skype.
How many people would pay $5 a piece?
Well, if we get you know what? If we see 1,000 people on there saying, you know, come to Tucson, I guess we would have to come to Tucson.
There you go.
Don't you think? If they all came. That's the problem. You get the hall. You get all dressed up. And you go, and then 5 people show up, and we're in trouble.
Maybe we should take the money first.
Yeah, pay us, and then we'll show up. Then we'll show up.
And I do want to put in a plug. The Podcast Academy is holding a new event at Boston University at the end of April. go to podcastacademy.org, and you can get more podcasting in 2 days than you'd ever want to see.
How much does it cost to take the academy?
It is, if you do it before March 15th, it's only $250.
That's
which,
great.
Which includes some meals.
Don't know what the Podcast Academy is.
The Podcast Academy is part of the Conversations Network. That's the nonprofit network that brings you IT Conversations. And the Podcast Academy is doing 4 events around the country this year, and hopefully one in Australia in January, to train people in the basics of podcasting.
Yeah, that's great.
And part of what we do is to record those events, and we'll be putting those online as free online courses in podcasting technology and tools.
As always.
So, I mean, it's I should point out, it's really good, wholesome, nuts and bolts information, and not just like, go out and buy a $700 microphone. Because everybody knows you need a $700 microphone.
I should hope
microphone.
Not.
Now, we've got some great people. I mean, at this one, we've got Tony Khan from WGBH will be talking. We've got Michael Gohagan from Grape Radio, and who produces the Disney podcast. We've got people who are really in the top tier of podcasting and public radio, talking
about
everything from the technology to the business side to podcasting and education.
That's awesome. That sounds wonderful.
Podcastacademy.org.
I was going to say, okay, podcastacademy.org. And of course, IT Conversations is at itconversations.com.
Right.
And that's a great place to find about 3,000 podcasts.
I forgot to tell you that membership in the Conversations Network is now free.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We discovered that none of our social tools were being used if we made them available to paid members only.
Right,
so
right.
It's a nonprofit, but guest membership is now free to everyone.
Good. That's great. Well done. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it, Doug. It's always great to talk to you.
A lot of
for
fun.
Your update on eTech.
Yeah.
And have a great day.
Thank you.
I want to thank also, of course, you, Patrick Norton, and Robert Herron for stopping by.
Hey, who we had on the show on Thursday?
What? Who?
I got to tell you.
Who?
We actually had Jeff Bates, a.k.a. Hemos from Slashdot.
Oh, how cool.
Which is really funny.
Oh, you're getting some great people. What did he talk about?
I talked to him a bunch about sort of the history of Slashdot and how it came together, and also about some of the stuff that's coming in the future, which includes some pretty serious mods to the interface involving Ajax.
Oh, boy. Yeah, our friend Kevin has rolled out Ajax commenting now in the dig, and it looks really slick. I'm sure Hemos and Commander Taco are looking at that going, why are we going to do a little Ajax ourselves? A little Ajax in there. DL.TV to see that show and all of the shows. And, of course, John C. Dvorak's new Cranky Geeks, which is a lot of fun. I look forward to another one of those. And Robert Herron, of course, joins you every day on DL.TV, too. Am I right?
You are.
Right, I am.
Thursdays.
On Thursdays. No, you do Tuesday and Thursday,
and Thursdays.
Though. Yeah. 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 Okay. Two a week. But every day you can watch one if you want.
You know, you can watch them over and over again if you want.
You don't have to watch live. You can watch.
Much like my relationship to Twit.
Over and over.
It's like a day without sunshine.
Thank you, Patrick. Our thanks to AOL Radio for providing us with the bandwidth and broadcasting the show on their podcast channel, AOL.com/podcasting, if you want to know more or subscribe. It's a great online radio service. You know, we're going to have our first advertisement on Twit in a couple of months, I think. Just
wow.
One. We're going to I'll tell you when the time comes, but it's just one. I just thought it'd be kind of interesting.
Will it be beginning, the middle? Will you read it out? This is
no, it's going to be pre-recorded. It'll be at the beginning. It'll be short. It's I can't tell you what it is yet, but the only reason we're doing it is just to see what happens.
Hooters?
Yeah, I'm very, very excited about this. And Robert, by the way, we will be looking for an endorsement from you. All right, guys, have a great afternoon. You know the Sopranos are on tonight. I'm gonna check out early because I gotta get my ziti in the oven to start baking. Have a great day. Another Twit is in the can.
I should have paid attention. I don't know what I'm going to do. Too much work. The problem is, there's no limit. My server's completely collapsed. So here's the deal. I'm just trying to get the thing up, but I have a hell of a time. What blue screens? Like, forget it. I'm killing you.